Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live a healthy, productive life. Details are at gatesfoundation.org. From FJC, a foundation of donor-advised funds, working to maximize the effectiveness of charitable giving at fjc.org. And from Plowshares Fund, dedicated to helping build a safe, secure, and nuclear weapon-free world at plowshares.org. This is NPR.
Stay with Iowa Public Radio next at 12 noon, the exchange from Iowa Public Radio News. The guest in the first half hour of the program, Republican Iowa Congressman Steve King of the 5th Congressional District. Talk of the Nation at 1 and at 2 o'clock, 3 o'clock BBC NewsHour. Still some cloudiness in northwest Iowa. Showers have moved out of the extreme southeast for the rest of today. Partly sunny, 40 degrees for a high today in the north, mid-50s in the south. It's 11:59.
Support comes from That Cellular Place, authorized agents for U.S. Cellular, now offering one-and-done contracts. That Cellular Place authorized agents available in Williamsburg, Washington, and Iowa City on the corner of Riverside Drive and Highway 1, minutes away from the U of I campus.
Support comes from Fired Up Iowa City, Inc., painting pottery for your home where the gnomes roam, and there is always coffee and tea. Open Tuesday through Sunday and really late on Fridays. Why not paint? On Facebook at Fired Up Iowa City, Inc.
This is Iowa Public Radio.
Local, national, and international news and information programming. You're listening to the news stream on Iowa Public Radio, 910 AM WSUI, Iowa City, Cedar Rapids, and online at iowapublicradio.org.
From Iowa Public Radio News, I'm Ben Kiefer. This is The Exchange. In the first half hour today, we'll talk with 5th District Republican Congressman Steve King. We'll get his view on issues likely to come up in the lame duck session and in the new Congress when the GOP takes control of the House in January. Then a conversation with former Marine Corps Captain Matthew Ho. In 2009, Ho resigned his State Department position over a U.S. policy. In 2009, Ho resigned his State Department appointment over U.S. policy in Afghanistan and became an outspoken critic of the conflict. Ho will speak to the Iowa City Foreign Relations Council on Tuesday. That's all coming up this hour, right after the news. This is The Exchange from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer, and my guest for this first half hour is Republican Congressman Steve King of Iowa's 5th District. He joins us by phone. Good afternoon, Congressman King.
Good afternoon, Ben. I'm happy to be with you.
Great to have you back. Republicans won control of the House of Representatives on November 2nd. Before those new representatives are sworn in, though, and the GOP takes control of the House, Congress will have a lame duck session. We want to talk with you, Congressman, about the pressing issues likely to come up. We want to reach out to our listeners right now and ask our listeners, what are your hopes or fears about the changes in Congress? What message do you want Congressman King to take back to Washington? 1-866-780-9100. The Exchange at iowapublicradio.org is our email. We're also on Twitter at IPR Talk. Congressman, a wrangle over extending tax cuts for millions of Americans will be seen as the first major test of whether President Obama and your resurgent Republicans can work together to fix the U.S. economy. Republicans want a full extension of all tax cuts enacted by then-President George W. Bush. President Obama and most Democrats favor extending tax cuts for the first $200,000 of individuals, the first $250,000 for families. Republicans want that extension for income above those levels. Now, a compromise in the lame duck session is being talked about, making all middle-class tax cuts permanent and extending the upper bracket rates for 2 to 3 years. Would you support such a compromise?
No, it's unlikely that I would, because it results in a tax increase to some Americans, and of course, a continuation of the tax brackets for the other Americans. This is a policy that's been in place, some of it for 10 years, and some of it for about 8, or one might say 7 and 9 years to split the hair. And we're at a time when we need to have a resurgent economy instead of a repressed economy. Mm-hmm. And a lot of those taxes at the upper brackets are the taxes that are applied to small businesses, entrepreneurs, individual sole proprietorships, and partnerships and LLCs. Mm-hmm. And that's where our job growth is, pick your number, whether it's 70 to 85% of our new jobs come from small business, and the tax bracket that would receive a tax increase under this proposal would inhibit the investment capital from creating new jobs. So I think it would be a mistake to exempt out anybody in the tax bracket, let everybody be under this same tax policy that we've had over the last nearly a decade. That'd be my position. And then additionally, no one's talking about the estate tax, which would be triggered at midnight on December 31st. And that's something that concerns me a great deal. It would be, I believe, immoral for this Congress not to address the estate tax, given that there will be end-of-life decisions made up to in the aftermath of the first of the year. We need to resolve that before it becomes a crisis around someone's deathbed in America.
You say your position is to have the tax cut extended for all income levels, all income brackets. But would you rule out supporting a compromise of any sort?
Well, you know, if I take a position on that particular question, then you know that it's not conducive to having a good policy on the other end of this. It's really going to come down to this: the Republican leaders need to sit down with the President of the United States and hammer this out. The President has been moving some. I appreciate his tone. I'm not willing to separate out a single bracket because that targets one income group at their expense and benefits everyone else. So I'm not willing to. We'll see what comes on the final package. There may be other things that get tied to that I can't contemplate and given with this question. So I'll say that what okay. I believe is right is make them permanent.
Now, extending the tax cuts in for the very wealthiest people in this country would cost an estimated $700 billion. Democrats say that would not only swell the budget deficit but have very little impact on cutting high employment. What evidence, concrete numbers, do you have that giving tax breaks to the richest will create a large number of jobs and invigorate the economy?
Well, let's first put that in perspective. $700 billion over 10 years does not – that factor does not contemplate two things. One is the annual will be $70 billion a year by their calculations, and second is it's not adjusted for – the numbers of jobs that would be lost if this tax increase is applied. And by the way, it's not possible to prove this. One can only look at old numbers and see trend lines and come to one opinion or the other. And mine is, and as a small businessman, and I'm at payroll for over 28 years, 1,400 and some consecutive weeks, I know what happens when my taxes go up. I pull back. And so will the entrepreneurs. And when you think of you heard, I think it was Dick Durbin or someone in the Senate who is leading on this proposal, said that the rich people, you know, it doesn't change their purchasing behaviors if they get a tax increase. That's probably true. They can live at the highest level that they want to, but it does change their investment tactics. And so that's the piece that's different, and some will understand that, some won't understand that. But I will tell you that I've been involved in business for a lot of years, and that's And that's something that is a standard when you're looking at investing money, which from the end result of that is it creates jobs.
Okay,
the distraction here.
We hope you have that taken care of. Congressman Steve King is joining us. Congressman, representative of Iowa's 5th District. If you'd like to get in a question, 1-866-780-9100. Congressman King, good enough to be with us until half past the hour. 1-866-780-9100. The Exchange at iowapublicradio.org. Our email. We're also on Twitter at IPRTalk. Broadening this out a little bit, how do you size up the overall potential for finding common ground in the new Congress? And on what issues are the best chances for you, the Republicans, Democrats, and the Obama administration, President Obama, to find common ground? Get something done.
Well, you know, I haven't really given that a lot of thought, given that the administration has not been looking for common ground over the last couple of years. In fact, I've dealt with the Pelosi Congress over the last four, and well, we've been shut out of the negotiations process continually and not even with good manners. And so I think that first thing we need to do is establish a working relationship. And I had noticed that coming into the elections that the Democrats essentially were not speaking to me and other Republicans, were coming over and having nice conversations. And so I think that they will come across, and we need to build actually, here's what I believe. We need to rebuild those personal bonds and relationships across the aisle that have been, I think, damaged by the polarized Congress that was led by Nancy Pelosi. I don't know whether John Boehner will be able to be successful in changing the tone of this Congress. I'm hopeful that he will be, and that's his pledge. So I'm going to continue to work along those lines, and we'll see what emerges and where the common ground might be. But I do think that we first have to rebuild the relationships and then identify those issues.
Okay, very good. 1-866-780-9100. Congressman Steve King with us of Iowa's 5th District. Let's go to our first caller, Gene from Iowa City. Good afternoon, Gene. Welcome to our program.
Yeah, hi. I would like Mr. King to just talk a little bit about his what he'd like to see happen with immigration policy in the country. There was a editorial in New York Times today that talked about some of the things that he's been wanting to do, and it sort of said that he stood up in the House chamber once and said that he built a mock-up border fence with wire on top, and he said, we could electrify the wire. We do that with livestock all the time. And just wondering whether he considers immigrants livestock, how he would pay for the things that he wants to do, how far back, if you don't have a birth certificate, or if you do have a birth certificate and it turns out maybe your great-great-grandfather was illegal, are they going to go back and try to catch all of us and kick us out?
Okay, a lot of things there, Gene. Let's get a response from Congressman King. We want to mention, too, in the new Congress, Congressman, you will likely serve as chairman of the U.S. House Subcommittee on Immigration, true?
That is what it looks like. The steering committee will make that decision, of course, but that's been reported, and I don't have indications otherwise. So I would just suggest that first I ask the Iowa City caller if he's interested in bipartisanship, and if he thinks that's a good idea, then I'd be happy to respond to those questions.
He's already gone from our line.
Okay.
He left our line. I guess he wanted to know about, if that's true, you put up an electrified fence.
I'll answer this then.
Yeah.
And that is, we just heard an example of what contributes to the undermining and the erosion of bipartisanship, and that's taking, whether it's right-wing or left-wing blog sites, and taking the information off of those, make the allegation from them as if they were fact, and then it just starts an argument. I don't want to start arguments. I want to try to find practical solutions. And if I go back and give you my exact quotes, I will tell you that I am most often misquoted, and especially in the left-wing blogs. And additionally, I would tell you that I sat down for interviews with the editorial board of the three major newspapers in my district, and each of them took issue with statements they alleged I had made, and in each case, they misquoted me and still insisted on writing the articles on the misquotes. So there's a tremendous amount of misinformation out there. Here's what I would say we need to do first on immigration, and that is, first, do the background work, the staff and the committee staff work, to pull together all the resources that we're using to enforce in the region of the border. And that is separate from the domestic enforcement. Evaluate all of those assets and make a determination as to whether they're properly distributed. For example, if we're picking up a lot of people at the border attempting to cross the border, and they're being released because we don't have prosecutors, we don't have judges, and we don't have prison beds, people that are that have committed crimes that should be treated in that fashion, we need to look at reapportioning all of those assets, and some of it, I think, needs to be invested in infrastructure, because we are chasing people all over the desert as far north as Phoenix. And when I talk to the Border Patrol, they tell me that they're interdicting perhaps 10% of those that attempt to cross. So that's not a very good return on about $12 billion. I think we need to get a better return on that internally and with employment. I believe that we should pass the New IDEA Act. New IDEA stands for the new. The acronym is Illegal Deduction Elimination Act. And what it does is it brings the IRS into the enforcement arena, and it clarifies that wages paid to illegals are not tax deductible. Therefore, those wages would go over into the income column, where the IRS then could levy a tax and a penalty and interest on that, which turns your $10 an hour illegal into about a $16 an hour illegal. And then that's the foundation by which we bring the IRS into this circle, along then with the Department of Homeland Security and the Social Security Administration. I require all three of them to set up a working committee to exchange information. That's a very constructive thing we can do. This should be bipartisan.
Can I ask you on the other side, not the enforcement side, but ask you under what circumstances would you be in favor of a path to citizenship for those who have entered this country illegally?
I can't imagine a scenario by which I would want to grant amnesty. And to grant amnesty is to pardon immigration lawbreakers and reward them with the objective of their crime. And so that's where I would stand. And we've got a long ways to go before we reestablish the rule of law. That's the primary goal. Once that becomes part of our country and part of our culture again, perhaps we could have that discussion. But at this point, it surely can't be something that's in any of the initial proposals that might come forward through the House.
Currently, anyone born in the U.S. is a U.S. citizen, including the children of undocumented workers in this country. Would you ever be in favor of working to change that, that people born in this country are a U.S. citizen merely by being born on this country, land?
Well, I would submit that, and this is the anchor babies component of this, for the shorthand version that's used quite often in these discussions. I have argued, and I believe, that the 14th Amendment of the Constitution, which says all persons born or naturalized in the United States and subject to the jurisdiction thereof are citizens of the United States. The clause that says and subject to the jurisdiction thereof contemplated that there would be babies born at that time. This is just immediately post-Civil War on Indian reservations, for example. Babies born to ambassadors and their families, a diplomatic corps, babies born to tourists, travelers, those exceptions were written in there to exempt those persons who were not subject to the jurisdiction of the United States. And additionally, the 14th Amendment of the Constitution was ratified in about 1868, which was immediately post-Civil War. At that time, we did not have immigration laws, so it could not have contemplated automatic citizenship. So I believe that we can address that by statute rather than constitutional amendment, and I believe that it is a piece of legislation I'd like to see moved, because it's turning it into tourism for the sake of citizenship for a baby to be born here, and it's costing American taxpayers billions in the long run.
Okay, so you would say undocumented workers, their children born in the U.S. should not be U.S. citizens?
Correct. And I wouldn't say undocumented workers. I would say illegal aliens.
Okay. Let's go back to the phones. We have just a few more minutes with Congressman Steve King of Iowa's 5th District. Let's go to Frank, who is in Boone. Good afternoon, Frank. Welcome to our program.
Hi, thank you. I was wondering how Representative King thought about this bipartisan commission report to reduce farm subsidies by $3 billion as an effort to balance the budget.
Okay, very good. The White House's Bipartisan Deficit Reduction Commission, considering a proposal, just to fill our listeners in who don't know about this, slash farm spending by $3 billion a year is the information I have. Government payments to farmers and landowners have been running about $12 billion a year. Of the annual fixed payments, $470 million goes to Iowa. That's the most of any state. Your position on cuts to farm spending, Congressman?
Okay, first of all, on the farm spending, about 70% of it does not go to farmers. About 30% does go to farmers. I think if we're going to go through and do the cuts that are necessary to get towards a balanced budget, and I'm not under illusions that we will get there this year with balancing the budget, I don't think we should exempt anyone from any entity from consideration. But I think if we looked at this just proportionally, that $3 billion proposal, I want to look at it across the board and see how that actually fits. One of the things that there is an argument, because we've seen our commodities prices go up, and when that happens, our land prices go up. And so it's hard to argue that it's now the subsidies are for the same purposes that they were instituted back in the 30s, for example. But one component of the direct payments, first I'd like to change the name of that and call them conservation compliance payments if they are part of the next farm bill, because that is the only thing we have to provide an incentive for producers to be good land stewards. And I think that needs to be contemplated in with this, but I would look at it as part of the whole perspective. I don't think any group or entity should be exempt except perhaps the military. And in that case, it's a case of getting more efficiency in the Pentagon, and I'm looking for that. I think that's something we need to look at, too.
Congressman King, you are in favor of repealing the health care overhaul, lock, stock, and barrel. Much of that reform is just now kicking in or has yet to start. I wanted to ask you about some of the very popular aspects of it, according to polling, the national high-risk insurance pool to provide coverage to people with pre-existing conditions, allowing children to stay on their parents' insurance until they're 26, no lifetime limits on how much money someone can receive from their health insurance plan. Why not use these, according to polls, very popular parts of the health care overhaul that Americans are in favor of as a basis and then refine it from there rather than kick the whole thing out?
Well, because Americans have rejected Obamacare and rejected it completely. And
not according to these polls. The aspects I just mentioned are popular according to polls.
You're talking about components of it. I'm
talking
about all of Obamacare. All Americans have rejected Obamacare completely. They're not new enough, and they say they want it all to go. That's, of course, what I've said. That's the legislation that I've introduced, the discharge petition that I brought in, the 173 signatures on it that are there from this Congress that's seated right now. To look at those exceptions that you've raised, that is, it's taken a long time since March to emerge with even any way to defend Obamacare, and you just listed all of them.
What about the Associated Press poll recently that found that 40% of respondents said health care reform did not go far enough? What do you say to those Americans who want more than they got in this overhaul, not less, or wipe it out completely?
I'd like to read that question and see who they asked before I could accept that. I saw the town hall meetings fill full of people, angry people. I saw the Capitol fill full of tens of thousands of people that said, keep your hands off of my health care. I've seen the polls since then support that same thing, all the way up to 61% say repeal it all. So let's go back to these components that you talked about. Insurance till age 26. We have two members of Congress right now that under that provision would be on their parents' health insurance when they were elected to Congress. I actually raised my kids to go out into the world and take care of themselves. Any state that wants to have that mandate can't have that. If the market demands it, anyone that wants it can buy it. So we don't need a federal mandate to impose that standard, a 26-year-old standard, on every insurance policy in America. Second, high-risk pools. We have those in Iowa, for example. And I have worked with that and helped with that program. I think that's the right way to go in the states. And I would be supportive of a federal effort to help with those high-risk pools in the states. But at the federal level, it crosses the line on federalism. And then let's see, what were the other two points you made?
Well, I made only one. Just to be clear, though, so you're arguing this on states' rights points, that the states should be allowed to do it, but let's not federally mandate it. That's your point.
Yeah, that is one of my points, yes.
The other
points to you that I, and I guess I hear the argument enough, it gets a little blurry with me on who actually asked the question. But, the mandatory issue, no pre-existing conditions.
Right.
That's another piece of language that's been relatively popular, but I don't think people have thought through what happens. People don't buy insurance if they don't need it. And if they can buy the insurance on the way to the hospital, that's what they will do. The only other thing that would control that is the penalty for not having insurance great enough to offset the cost of the insurance itself if you only buy it when you're sick. So,
But why should people with pre-existing conditions, why should people who genetically have some pre-existing conditions, and as technology moves forward, we will find more and more people with pre-existing conditions as dictated by their genes, why should they be left without health insurance?
Well, they won't be. They'll be under the high-risk pool, and we're going to help those people.
Okay.
And I think we should do that within the states and then support it and promote it from the federal government, but not mandate. These mandates, if you start down the line of mandates, that's what's made insurance prohibitively expensive in many of the states, such as New Jersey, where a typical policy for a 25-year-old healthy male might cost $6,000 compared to a typical policy for the same age healthy individual in Kentucky might cost $1,000 a year. That's what mandates do for you, and they make insurance unaffordable. And if we make it unaffordable, eventually the government will run it all, and we will lose our freedoms. This is about personal liberty more so than it even is about health care.
Congressman King, in our next half hour, we're going to be talking, the focus will be on Afghanistan, and that's where I'd like to leave the conversation with you in the remaining 90 seconds we have. The Obama administration has developed a plan to begin transferring security duties in the select areas of Afghanistan to the country's that country's forces. It's the transfer would take place over the next 18 to 24 months with an eye toward ending American combat mission there by 2014. To what extent do House Republicans see eye to eye on the conduct of the war in Afghanistan with the president?
You know, I've been over there three times and into the region, most recently in the first week in August. And what I've noticed since the Obama administration came in is that we get less and less candid answers from our classified briefings. I'm not able to get what I think are very good answers in Afghanistan. I don't think the president has yet articulated our mission there. And so to set up a strategy for pulling out of Afghanistan without first articulating our mission and not being able to determine whether that mission is accomplished, I've always opposed the idea of having a date certain or even a date implied to disengage. It gives an advantage to the enemy. But I'm willing to work with the president, and I've been supportive of this mission. I'm just uneasy about it, and I think the president needs to articulate the goals of this, these missions in Afghanistan. And I think Republicans are more inclined to support him in that than our Democrats.
Okay, Congressman King, you hear our music, not your cell phone's music. It's our music. Thank you very much for joining us. Steve King of Iowa's 5th District.
Glad to do it, Ben. Thanks.
Okay, coming up, we'll talk about Afghanistan, U.S. policy in Afghanistan, and someone who is an outspoken critic of it. When we return, this is The Exchange from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. The Obama administration has developed a plan to begin transferring security duties in select areas of Afghanistan to that country's forces. The transfer would take place over the next 18 to 24 months with an eye toward ending the American combat mission there by 2014. The four-year plan to wind down American and allied fighting in Afghanistan will be presented at a NATO summit meeting later this week. This is according to anonymous sources quoted in today's New York Times. Joining me now is Matthew Ho. Ho is a former captain in the Marine Corps who served both in Iraq and Afghanistan. He's also a former State Department appointee. In 2009, he resigned from his appointment in Afghanistan in protest of the strategy used in the war. Ho is now director of the Afghanistan Study Group and a senior fellow at the Center for International Policy. Matthew Ho will speak on Tuesday before the Iowa City Foreign Relations Council. Matthew Ho, welcome to The Exchange.
Hi, Ben. Thanks for having me on.
What's your opinion on the latest news of a plan to end combat in Afghanistan by 2014?
Well, I think it's an unfortunate continuation of the current policies that we've been pursuing in Afghanistan for several years now. Really, since 2005, the United States and NATO, along with the Afghan central government, have had a policy of trying to basically pacify rural parts of the country. This announcement that we will proceed into 2014 means that if things do not turn around, if things do not get markedly better, and based upon all the metrics, all the evidence of the last 5 years, that's not going to occur. We're looking at about 2,500 dead American and coalition troops. We're looking at thousands more dead Afghan civilians. And we're looking at a price tag of about $500 billion if we keep up the same pace until 2014.
Now, an anonymous American official quoted in this article in the New York Times today said, Iraq is a pretty decent blueprint for how to transition in Afghanistan. American forces have tripled in Afghanistan under President Obama. Commander General David Petraeus, the same commander we had in Iraq, has expressed confidence that they are making progress. Why won't you don't seem to be agreeing that a surge here will have the same effect in Afghanistan that it did in Iraq? Why not?
Well, the conditions are so very different between the two countries in terms of terrain, population, the nature of the conflict. You know, there wasn't a conflict in Iraq until we entered into the country. Afghanistan, that conflict had been going on for 20 years before we entered into the country in 2001. So we're entangled in basically a civil war that's been ongoing for three decades now. And so the problem I see with our current strategy is that we're not addressing the actual causes of the conflict. The conflict in Afghanistan, like I said, is three decades long. It's multi-tiered. It's multi-layered. It goes along ethnic lines. It goes along regional lines. It goes along sectarian lines so that it's in many cases our troops are caught in what's best kind of described as a Hatfield and McCoy type situation. And so what I see our policy doing is our policy is basically taking one side in the conflict without understanding that the other side may have a legitimate grievance, and they're just not going to give up on it. And, you know, to wrap this all back around to why we're there in the first place, what we're doing right now has no effect on al-Qaeda. Al-Qaeda is not an organization that exists currently in Afghanistan. It's an organization that exists, you know, around the world and operates through individuals and small cells that are connected by the Internet. So, I mean, that's the thing that I think the American people have to ask, is that even if we do expend all these resources till 2014, how does that make the U.S. safer?
Mm-hmm. Matthew Ho, describe your work in Afghanistan before resigning in 2009.
Okay, I was a political officer for the State Department. So my position was to work with the Afghan government officials. So I was stationed in both eastern Afghanistan and southern Afghanistan. And basically my job was to work with the Afghan governors, just as we have military officers who are embedded with the police or who are embedded with the Afghan army, and they mentor and train them. My role was similar with the Afghan government in the sense that I worked every day with the Afghan government, particularly when I was in southern Afghanistan, lived next door to and, you know, ate a couple meals a day with and constantly traveled with the governor of a province in southern Afghanistan.
You resigned from this State Department appointment in 2009, and if we recall, about a year ago, this was when the period when President Obama was pondering what to do in Afghanistan, eventually deciding on a 30,000 troop surge. Your resignation came many months before actually any of those surge troops were on the ground. When did you first have doubts about U.S. involvement in Afghanistan?
Well, you know, one of the things I think people need to understand is that we've been surging troops, and when I say we, it includes NATO. I've been surging troops in Afghanistan since 2005. Since 2005, either ourselves or our NATO partners have doubled our troop presence in Afghanistan, and all we've seen is a commensurate growth in support for the Taliban, a commensurate growth in the size of the conflict, and a commensurate decline in support for the Karzai government. So those 30,000 troops that President Obama ordered last December were really just the final tranche of many of multiple surges that have occurred since 2005. Many people probably forget that as soon as the president got in office in March of 2009, he ordered 21,000 more U.S. troops into Afghanistan. We sent several thousand more Marines into southern Afghanistan in the spring of 2008, which a lot of people forget about. So as soon as I got there, I was having my doubts and issues, and I had them before anyway because I had so many friends and colleagues who had served there or were serving there, and it just didn't seem that this strategy that we were employing was going to be successful because it wasn't going after those root causes of the conflict. It wasn't addressing those political grievances. And in a lot of ways, it was excluding people from the government and pushing them towards the insurgency in the sense that we were supporting one side of the conflict. And so we were alienating or excluding the rural Pashtuns, and that was pushing them to support the Taliban. And this is very similar to what we did in Iraq from 2003 to 2006 when our policies excluded the Sunnis from the government, where they were excluded from the security forces. And so you see a very similar type of effect in Afghanistan where the more we prop up the Karzai government, the more we build up the security forces, and we don't include whole society in those in the government and in security forces, it just pushes people to support the insurgency.
Can you tell us about what happened after your resignation? I thought that was interesting. You were actually asked to stay on, given other appointments.
I was offered a position by Ambassador Eikenberry to remain in Kabul, and then I was offered a position on Ambassador Holbrooke, Ambassador Eikenberry being our ambassador in Afghanistan, and then offered a position by Ambassador Holbrooke, who is this United States' special representative for Afghanistan and Pakistan, to be on his team here in Washington, D.C. And I accepted the position from Ambassador Holbrooke for a couple days and then decided that that was not the right thing for me to do.
If you've just joined us, I'm speaking with Matthew Ho, former captain in the Marine Corps. He served both in Iraq and Afghanistan, former State Department appointee.
In 2009, he resigned from his appointment in Afghanistan in protest of the strategy used in the war. He's now director of the Afghanistan Study Group, also a senior fellow at the Center for International Policy. Matthew Ho will be in Iowa City on Tuesday to speak before the Iowa City Foreign Relations Council. So tell us about the Afghan Study Group. What is the purpose of your group?
Well, we're really, I guess network is probably the best way to describe us. And there, we've have about 60 members now, both individuals and organizations, all who are foreign policy practitioners or experts, whether they be academics or former government officials or former military. And what we are is a collection or a consensus of, like I said, individuals and organizations who believe that the current U.S. policy in Afghanistan is excessive in its costs, is counterproductive in the sense that our policies are making the conflict worse. People are supporting the Taliban because of our presence there. Mm-hmm. And it's, so it's destabilizing the region. And it's not having an effect on Al-Qaeda.
So what is the best course for the U.S. to take at this point? Simply pull all troops out of Afghanistan as soon as possible?
Oh, absolutely not. We're not in favor of and when no one in the group is advocating abandoning or cutting and running. You know, Ben, and that's one of the problems you get into when you talk about these things. You're either all in or all out. And I don't really know anyone who's either that extreme in either case. But what we're calling for, and if your listeners want to go, they can read our report. They can find it online at AfghanistanStudyGroup.org. We have five recommendations. Well, the first thing we do is we assess what are the U.S.'s vital interests in that region, and we assess them to be Al-Qaeda and other transnational terror groups and the security of Pakistan's nuclear weapons and, of course, the relationship between Pakistan and India. And so taking it from that approach, we see our current policy in Afghanistan to not be really achieving either of those or vital interests for us. And so we have five recommendations, and they're all to be done, and we recommend them to be done in parallel, not in series, but to be done in parallel. And they are internal political reconciliation, power-sharing agreements, basically a negotiated settlement to end, 30 years of warfare in Afghanistan, a reduction in U.S. combat forces, particularly in southern Afghanistan, where we see our troop presence as being a catalyst for people to support the insurgency. We advocate refocusing on Al-Qaeda and attacking Al-Qaeda as they exist. We like to be seen as Al-Qaeda hawks. We're not saying that Al-Qaeda is not a threat. In fact, we're saying that our focus on Afghanistan as it is actually distracting us from Al-Qaeda, and mm-hmm. that's very dangerous.
So you're saying negotiate with the Taliban, bring them into the tent, but make sure that their links with Al-Qaeda cannot exist, and that the Taliban will not harbor Al-Qaeda as it did pre-9/11.
Absolutely, absolutely. And you know, and there may be some elements of the Taliban that are not willing to do that. Well, then you isolate them, just like we did in Iraq, in a sense that people will point to the surge in Iraq as an example of success, and in some ways it was, or in a lot of ways it was, but not because we just sent 20 or 30,000 more troops there. It was because of the political efforts that we did in Iraq to bring the insurgency into the fold, basically to flip the insurgency. I was in Anbar province in Iraq in 2006-2007, and I saw us go from having the insurgency in Anbar, literally putting roads in the side of the bomb 1 week, and then being on the street and patrolling with us the next. So that's what we're talking about in Afghanistan. Is a lot of the vast majority of those who support the Taliban do not support Al Qaeda. The vast majority of those who support the Taliban do not support the Taliban's ideological goals or aims. Most of them have legitimate grievances that don't probably pass a valley or village boundary. So what we're saying is address those. And in this way, you can probably reconcile with 80% of the insurgency that way, because the insurgency is not monolithic. It's composed of many, many multiple groups that are very, very local in nature and whose grievances can be addressed through political settlements. And by this way, you're not fighting the whole insurgency. Now maybe you've reconciled with 80%, and so now you only have to deal with 20%. And that's a much more manageable task. It's much easier to isolate and to eventually neutralize. So that's what we're calling for when we recommend political settlement and power-sharing agreements and reconciliation. And then our fourth and fifth points are to redo the way we do development in Afghanistan. The U.S. has spent $50 billion on development in Afghanistan, and we've not seen the results. In the sense of helping to stabilize the country. We've spent $50 billion in the country's every year. The country, the war gets worse and worse in the country. And then finally, the fifth one is have a regional dialogue, bring in Afghanistan's neighbors, and commit them to agreeing on Afghanistan's neutrality. If Afghanistan's neighbors don't agree to treat Afghanistan as a neutral nation and don't agree to not interfere in Afghanistan's internal affairs, all we're suggesting is not going to work. So that regional dialogue, that the getting that regional settlement is very important for ensuring Afghanistan's neutrality and any hopes for stability going into the future for Afghanistan.
Talk more about Pakistan's role. You mentioned two of the priorities there, Pakistan's nuclear capability, also the Pakistan-India relationship there. Have they changed recently in such a way at all, moving toward a situation where Pakistan can be more of a help than a hindrance in regards to those border areas?
Well, you know, I mean, Pakistan, there's such a lack of transparency in how the Pakistani government and the military and their intelligence services work. We just don't have a good feel or understanding of who's in charge and what their motivations are. So you do have elements within the Pakistani government and the military that want to stabilize the region, that want to normalize relations with India to a certain degree, that see having a proxy war in Afghanistan for the last however many years with India of not benefiting Pakistan, of having been really just a detriment to them. But then you have others who within the government who are still convinced that they need to control or to that they need to control and have a significant degree of influence in Afghanistan to provide them strategic depth against India, because they see India as their archenemy. They focus near completely on India. And so until Pakistan, you know, and the Pakistani government, the Pakistani military and intelligence services gets that under control, we're going to have some severe difficulty in stabilizing Afghanistan, because as long as there are elements within the Pakistani establishment that see the need to foster violence and to support militant groups within Afghanistan, ostensibly to support Pakistan's interests, you're just going to have a completely destabilized situation. Then, unfortunately, it doesn't just destabilize Afghanistan, but bleeds over and destabilizes Pakistan, and then by extension, because now you've seen so many of those militant groups that the Pakistanis have stood up over the last couple of decades now slipping out from control of the Pakistani government, it also destabilizes India as well.
Matthew Ho is my guest, former captain in the Marine Corps, served both in Iraq and Afghanistan, also a former State Department appointee. In 2009, he resigned from his appointment in Afghanistan in protest of the strategy used in the war. He's now director of the Afghanistan Study Group, senior fellow at the Center for International Policy, and will be speaking Tuesday before the Iowa City Foreign Relations Council. Matthew, go into a little more detail about how we get Pakistan more on board. The U.S. President Obama on his Asian tour recently visiting India, and also we've had some natural disasters striking Pakistan. How do we work on that so that Pakistan is more on board in terms of ending the combat in Afghanistan?
That's a really difficult question. I think the first thing is understanding our relationship with Pakistan and Pakistan's relationship with us as well as its other neighbors. I think most people in the U.S. would expect that Pakistan's main ally would be the United States. It's actually not. Pakistan says that its main ally is China. I think most people in the United States would find that surprising, given the vast amounts of foreign assistance we provided to Pakistan over this last decade. So I think the first thing is understanding what Pakistan's going through, understanding that it has had insurgencies in Sindh and Baluchistan provinces since its formation, since its creation, you know, in the late 40s, and it has had this really terrible insurgency now in western Pakistan, the Pashtun areas, for the better part of the last decade, or certainly for the last 3, 4, 5 years. So understanding the inherent turmoil and conflict within the country. So it's a very difficult question, and I think what it really comes down to is having a much better understanding of what Pakistan's looking for, having a better understanding of how our actions are having effect on that psyche. And then, yeah, I mean, in terms of you know, the president just visited India, he didn't stop by Pakistan, and that affects the Pakistanis a great deal because, again, in the western part of the country, we're having drones shoot missiles every day, and in India, President Obama goes and visits Pakistan's biggest enemy and says, "I want to help you get on the Security Council." Well, that really plays into this issue of mistrust that the Pakistanis have with us. And so it's, how do you build that trust, and then how do you get yourselves back into this engagement with Pakistan where we understand what's happening within the government, we understand what's happening within the military and the intelligence services, and what we help them stabilize their country. Right now, I think we keep bombing part of their country and threatening and offering to give them a lot of money so they can buy F-16s, and both are counterproductive in the long run.
You say that your proposal or your suggestion is not to cut and run, and neither is obviously the administration's. They have a plan to end Afghan combat by 2014. Can you concisely give us the difference between your recommendations, the plan that you would put forward, and the plan in ending combat within 4 years, as the Obama administration seems to be doing?
Sure. I think our two biggest the two biggest differences are our emphasis on political reconciliation, our emphasis on talking to the insurgency, addressing their grievances. Again, many of those grievances are local, don't extend past the village or valley boundary, and they may just be issues that go back a couple decades in terms of a power struggle within a local community that we've taken one side of. So some of that is just basically pull ourselves out of those situations. Get us out of these situations where it doesn't matter to us.
Matthew Ho is a former captain in the Marine Corps, served both in Iraq and Afghanistan, former State Department appointee. He resigned from his appointment in Afghanistan in protest of the strategy used in the war. Now he is director of the Afghanistan Study Group, senior fellow at the Center for International Policy. Matthew Ho will speak on Tuesday before the Iowa City Foreign Relations Council. Matthew Ho, thank you for joining us today.
Thanks, Ben. Appreciate it.
The Exchange is produced by Catherine Perkins and Alex Hoyer. Technical support from Dennis Reese. The executive producer of Iowa Public Radio's talk shows is Jeff Schmidt. Podcasting and on-demand audio of The Exchange, available at iowapublicradio.org. We always welcome your comments and questions about this program. Contact us anytime at this email, theexchange@iowapublicradio.org. Our theme music was composed and performed by Dan Knight. The Exchange is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us.